Good evening, Earth Explorers. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWeather window forecast: 84 degrees and clear. Perfect night for watching meteors. X Squared Radio is where the past meets the future, and here the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So much going on in the news tonight. Oh my goodness, it's hard to keep up with. But I'm glad you're here, and I want to encourage you to be part of the program tonight. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. We also have the conference line going. If you want to step out, you can still listen a couple of different ways. One is by dialing 760-569-7676. And then the access code 192-919-pound. That will get you in with your cell phone. You can be out walking around listening. Or you can go to xsquaredradio.com if you have a Droid phone. And you can click on the Droid app. All one click and you're in. Simple as that. You'll be listening to X Squared Radio anytime you want, by the way. You don't have to just listen to our program. BBS Radio is the number one webcast radio network on the web anywhere. And X Squared Radio is the number one program, usually. Hopefully you all are here tonight making us number one. The solar wind tonight is 396 kilometers per second. Proton count is around 0.8 protons per cubic centimeter. It's a little elevated. There are, however, six sunspot clusters on the sun right now, crackling with C-class flares. And there was, earlier this week, a giant magnetic filament stretching across the entire sun, but it dissipated without a CME. I will say we dodged a huge solar bullet. The sun's maximum is gearing up, and solar scientists have no idea what is going to happen. We're in uncharted territory. But I would hold to the conclusion we drew in the Arc of Millions of Years. If you don't have that series, I highly recommend that you pick it up. There are four books in the series. The first two are backed up with audio. You can get them by going to arcofmillionsofyears.com. You'll get them all autographed and the audio versions of one and two. I'm still working on three for free. And beyond that, you can also get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere where fine books are sold. Earth is passing through a stream of debris from Comet Swift-Tuttle. Source of the annual Perseids meteor shower. And the best time to watch those is in the early dawn hours. Those of you that are going to stay up late or got up early this morning, if you missed it, you missed it. But you might be able to see it tonight. Some people are reporting up to 100 meteors per hour. Forecasters recommend, you know, the dark hours before dawn when activity is expected to be the highest. We have some conference updates. The economy has taken its toll on lots of things and lots of people. Our good friend Nancy Wallace out in Arizona, the Wake Up Now conference has been canceled. Evidently, not enough people signed up for it, and there is not enough economics to get it going. It is being rescheduled for May, and the admission price is being reduced to free. So I will update the banner on the website at xsquaredradio.com. If you click on that, you can sign up for the conference for nothing. All you have to do is show up, and you'll get to hear the speakers and access all the vendors and everything else that goes on at these fine conferences. Also, an update on the Maya 2012 conference. Yes, you, Earth Explorers, responded in the hundreds accessing that website via that banner. However, none of you have signed up. None of you have put a deposit down. And so this global conference, which is reported to be one of the finest conferences and one of the hottest spots on the planet for 2012 genre ideas and speakers and activities. You can't get a hotel room within 500 miles of this place now. It is definitely the place to be. There is still time. You can go to the Maya 2012 banner and you can sign up. Now, I realize that times are what they are, but this is no ordinary conference. I'm telling you that I'm going to be there. I want you all to be there with me. And if you see yourself there, I'm just reminding you, click on the Maya 2012 banner, get your deposit in, and make payments if you have to. Get this thing done. We're going to be down there from the 13th of December to the 22nd of December. I promise to have you home by Christmas, and you will have stories to tell. Also, if you don't have a passport, you don't feel like traveling outside the country at that time of year, you can join me at the Pythagoras Conference in southern Indiana. That banner, if you click on it at xsquaredradio.com, you will get $100 off, which is a great value. This is something you can drive to. You know, we never have conferences like this in the Midwest, so get yourself down there. One of the other things that we implore you to do in the last three books that I have written, in the last chapter, because people ask me all the time, what do I do to get ready? What do I do to get ready? Well, one of the things that you need to do, of course, is to very slowly, very carefully, not all at once, not suddenly, not enough to make anybody alarmed, you need to get all your cash out of the bank. Just leave enough cash in there to take care of the drafts and things that normally automatically come out of your account. But there is huge trouble brewing in the primary and secondary banking markets, and you have no idea how quickly your money can disappear. FDIC or no FDIC, there is nothing backing that money. You might want to pick up some silver. I don't recommend buying gold. It's far too expensive. It's far too valuable. You would never be able to transport it, and more than likely, your life would be in danger if you had large amounts of gold. But silver is accessible. I buy mine in little one-ounce ingots. It's not very expensive, about $30. Tuck a couple away each paycheck, and before you know it, you got 3 or 4 pounds of silver. Now you have something that can get yourself and your family out of a jam if the currencies go down. The other thing that I suggest is, of course, food storage. And you know how over the years we have searched for a good affiliate that can provide food. Well, we found one. We have it posted on the website. It's at the very top on the right-hand side where the affiliates are at xsquaredradio.com. The Food Investor, that's right. Even though you may have some silver, you may have some gold, you can't eat it. And if the weather or some other natural disaster or a dam or an earthquake or a fire or, heaven help us, a military activity should occur, you will be able to provide for yourself and your family. Come on, you know it's the right thing to do. You know it's the right thing to do. Now, I'm not talking about going down to the grocery and buying extra canned goods. That stuff's heavy, hard to transport. I recommend going to the Food Investor and getting this delicious food. It is really, really good tasting and good for you. This group in Utah has figured out how to make this stuff last for 30 years. So once you set it, you can forget it. Put it in a pack by the door, ready to go. And if you have to vacate your house in a hurry, you can vacate with 3 or 4 days of food already packed up and ready to go. The Food Investor. Click on the banner. find out more. Now, we have some breaking news. Normally, we don't do politics on this program. We will do political science. Hold on while I take a sip of my lovely grapefruit juice. I cut it with water. No, Kathy out there who asked the question, I don't put vodka in the grapefruit juice. Anyway, one of the breaking news items is that Daryl Issa, you know who he is, the head of the House Oversight and Government Reform, he's the chairman. Tomorrow, this is really breaking news, tomorrow he is going to sue Attorney General Eric Withholder, Holder, for refusing to provide documents related to the Fast and Furious gun smuggling operation. Now, we know these operations have been going on in the past. You know, we have Iran-Contra went on and on and on. Those of you that are old enough to remember those trials. I met Oliver North in person, by the way, years after that. Not as big a guy as I thought he was going to be. At the time, he was running for Senate in Tennessee, and I was part of the group doing some supporting activities for that. So this kind of activity has been going on for a while, and it often comes under congressional scrutiny. But the committee expects to file the civil contempt suit against the Attorney General tomorrow on Monday. The suit will be filed in the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia. The action is the latest escalation. I'd say it's a grand game of chicken in the dispute between House Republicans and the Justice Department over the documents, which relate to a botched gun smuggling operation. Actually, it was not botched. It did exactly what the Department of Justice wanted it to do, except that one U.S. Border Patrol agent was killed. If you read the book Alienated Nation, my latest book, in there is a resolution that was drafted by the Hispanic members of Congress, and it is blazingly hot. The accusations made in this resolution are really acts of war. The fact that we fed weapons to known criminals in a foreign country, and hundreds, perhaps thousands of civilians lost their lives in the crossfire from the proliferation of these excellent automatic weapons. The gun stores that sold the weapons at first refused to do it. They did not want to sell the weapons to characters such as drug cartel members, but they were forced to do it by the Department of Justice. On June 28th, the House voted to hold Holder, now nicknamed Withholder, in contempt of Congress and authorize the oversight panel to bring suit to enforce its rights. In Fast and Furious, agents for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, this bureau just continues to grow. You know, this was the group that empowered Elliot Ness. Because, you know, alcohol is subject to such black market things. We've got to make our taxes off the alcohol. And, oh, forget about tobacco. Don't forget about that. We've got to have the tax stamp on that and collect that. Firearms, of course, we have to, you know, link firearms with alcohol and tobacco. They, of course, go together. And now we've added explosives to it. I'm surprised there isn't spent chewing gum in there as well. Anyway, they allow these guns to walk, which meant ending surveillance on weapons suspected to be en route to Mexican drug cartels. They didn't walk the guns. They bought them and sold them into the cartels on purpose. The tactic, which was intended to allow agents to track criminal networks by finding the guns at crime scenes. Gee, why would you find a gun at a crime scene? Yeah, that's right. That's after the place gets hosed down. That's right. There are already dead bodies at a crime scene where automatic weapons are found laying around. These guys don't give up the weapons unless you pry their cold, dead fingers from around it. Get it? Anyway, it was condemned after two guns that were part of the operation were found at Border Patrol agent Brian Terry's murder scene. Brian Terry, by the way, was armed with beanbags. Yeah, beanbags. In the most recent conflict between Congress and the president over a congressional subpoena, Democrats and Republicans' roles were reversed. The Democrat-led House held two White House aides, Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten, in contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with subpoenas issued to the George W. Bush administration. Republicans, including Issa, defended the administration while Democrats said it was unlawful. After the House held Myers and Bolton in contempt, the Judiciary Committee sued the two aides in federal district court. Well, turnabouts, fair play. In August of 2008, a federal judge ordered Myers to testify and Bolton to turn over documents overruling the administration's claim of executive privilege, and the ruling was appealed. In March of 2009, a year after the suit was filed, Myers and Carl Rove, who had also become ensnared in a separate contempt proceeding, agreed to testify behind closed doors to the House Judiciary Committee, and the deal broke the stalemate. Well, that same kind of deal was made to Holder, but he showed up with a post-it note and a refusal to deliver the documents and basically said, boys, take your best shot. Well, Mr. Holder, you have already made history by being found in contempt of Congress, and now you're going to be sued in federal court, and hopefully you will go to prison. A Mexican prison. Now, there's some strange stuff going on in the weather. You know, there's have been two 6.5 plus earthquakes in Iran, and emergency support operations are underway as we speak. Obviously, a 6.5 earthquake in Iran is much more devastating than a 6.5 earthquake in downtown Los Angeles because L.A. is built for it. Iran is not. When those buildings come apart, they kill people and crash into the streets, and that's exactly what's happened. Now, there are rumors, and then rumors about the rumors and rumors squared, that HAARP was being used on Iran to destabilize the ground and cause these earthquakes to occur. I will say, it is rare to have an earthquake. It is rare squared to have two earthquakes like this in separate places in a single day. That's a little bit more like fingerprints. And in more weirdness, in Bangladesh, at least 13 devotees have been killed by lightning outside a mosque in northeastern Bangladesh. Local police chief Baez Ahmed says 20 other people were injured by the lightning late Friday in Sylhet district. The victims were struck by the lightning as they were exiting the mosque following special prayers tied to the holy month of Ramadan. Ahmed said Saturday that some of those who were killed died at the scene, while others died on the way to the hospital. He said the imam who led the prayers was among the dead. The fasting month of Ramadan is being observed across Bangladesh, a Muslim-majority nation. Sylhet district is 192 kilometers northeast of the capital, Dhaka. Just so you know, we support any kind of fasting and prayer here. That kind of placement of intention for the good of mankind is always supported. Hopefully, we're not out there praying for the destruction of our enemies. I don't think Bangladesh has too many enemies, so maybe not. But then again, even Jesus had enemies. Now, in the domestic scene, what we talked about in Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, was a lot of history that had to do with the Civil War, what some people call the Civil War. Here in the South, we call it the recent unpleasantness. It's also called the War Between the States, the War of Northern Aggression. I think all of those names are fitting in different aspects, different points of view. But imagine Tea Party extremists seizing control of a South Carolina town and the army being sent in to crush the rebellion. This farcical vision is now part of the discussion. in professional military circles. Oh, yes. At issue is an article in the respected Small Wars Journal titled Full Spectrum Operations in the Homeland, A Vision of the Future. It was written by retired Army Colonel Kevin Benson of the Army's University of Foreign, Military, and Cultural Studies at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and Jennifer Weber, a Civil War expert at the University of Kansas. It posts an extremist militia motivated by the goals of the Tea Party movement seizing control of Darlington, South Carolina in the year 2016, occupying City Hall, disbanding the city council and placing the mayor under house arrest. The rebels set up checkpoints on Interstate 95 and Interstate 20 looking for illegal aliens. It's a cartoonish and needlessly provocative scenario. I will admit that. But the article is a choppy patchwork of doctrinal jargon and literal nightmare. The authors make a quasi-legal case for military action and then apply the Army's operating concept 2016 through 2028 to the situation. They write bloodlessly that once it is put into play, Americans will expect the military to execute without pause and as professionally as if it were acting overseas. They claim that the Army cannot disappoint the American people, especially in such a moment, not pausing to consider that using such efficient deadly force against U.S. citizens would create a monumental political backlash and severely erode government legitimacy. Well, I could tell you, Jennifer, and Colonel Kevin, that just talking about this in professional military circles creates political backlash and severely erodes government legitimacy. I made the statement in the book, and I have also made the statement publicly in other venues, other radio interviews and conferences, and even in discussions with my colleagues, that the folks down at Wars R Us don't need a reason for war. They only need a weapon. This vision is hard to take seriously, and yet we watch it on the television almost every night as we watch various militaries around the world fight their own people. As retired Army Brigadier General Russell D. Howard, a former professor at West Point, observed earlier in his career, "I am a colonel. Colonels write a lot of crazy stuff, but no one listens to colonels, so I don't see the problem." 20 years ago, then Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Charles J. Dunlap Jr. created a stir with an article in Parameters titled "The Origins of the American Military Coup of 2012. No, it was an alienated nation. It carried a disclaimer that the coup scenario was purely a literary device intended to dramatize my concern over certain contemporary developments affecting the armed forces, and is emphatically not a prediction. The scenario presented in Small Wars Journal isn't a literary device, but an operational laydown intended to present the rationale and mechanisms for Americans to fight Americans. It's been done before, as Jennifer well knows. Colonel Benson and Ms. Weber contend Army officers are professionally obligated to consider conduct of operations on U.S. soil. Really, they are professionally obligated to consider conduct of operations on U.S. soil. This is a dark, pessimistic, and wrong-headed view of what military leaders should spend their time studying. I totally agree. A professor at the Joint Forces Staff College was relieved of duty in June for uttering the heresy that the United States is at war with Islam. Huh. Imagine that. The Obama administration contended the professor had to be relieved because what he was teaching was not U.S. policy, because there is no disclaimer attached to the Small Wars piece it is fair to ask, at least in Colonel Benson's case, whether his views reflect official policy regarding the use of U.S. military force against American citizens. I suppose that Colonel Benson has not been relieved of duty. I suppose that Miss Weber is definitely being considered an expert in this area, as she relates the tensions and patterns that gave us the Civil War to the present day. Why would she do that? I wonder what was building up in the article. I can tell you the tensions that brought the Civil War on. It's pretty common knowledge down here in the South. Of course, we have a completely different viewpoint of the rest of the world and the North. But the viewpoint is that we were being taxed into oblivion. Our trade with Europe was being blockaded. Our ships were being boarded and money and goods were being seized. And it was time for the North to go. And so we kicked them out of Sumter. Yes, we did. We bombarded them for 36 hours, but no one was killed. You know, it was all in good fun. And Major Anderson and his people, all but one, of course, he died as a result of an accidental cannon incident that the North did with their own cannons at Sumter during a 100-gun salute that was summarily truncated to 50 as the 47th cannon exploded, killing one of the cannoneers. So they said, I'll tell you what, guys, let's just shoot the last three off and get out of here. So they marched them out, and that was pretty much it until the North declared war on the South. And, you know, the rest is American history. And there are all kinds of sides as to who was right and who was wrong, but at the end of the day, the winners are the ones that write the history, right? So what kind of civil war are we talking about? Are we really talking about Tea Party extremists doing this? Are you serious? I don't think so. It's not Tea Partiers that are occupying the streets, turning cars over, throwing Molotov cocktails, defacing things, occupying and terrorizing small businesses along the curbs of our cities. It's not Tea Partiers that are doing that. It's anarchists that are doing that. What kind of organization do they want? None. Now, I'm not saying we should tear apart everything that's going on. Certainly, there are some changes that need to be made. But, you know, there's a different way of looking at it. We don't need to do violence, and we absolutely do not need to consider using federal troops against American citizens. I have a little bit more in the news that I want to cover because yesterday, exactly as we predicted here on this program several times, Paul Ryan has been selected as the VP, and I want to cover some of the aspects of that, not from a political standpoint, but from a political science standpoint. But right now we have a caller on the line from Austin, Texas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Brooks.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing good, and I'm. How are you?
I actually got better. I've almost 100% healed from my motorcycle death. I started fixing the bike this week. Started taking the parts off it; they were all crumpled. And actually, the frame and the motor are still in good shape, so we might resurrect the old girl.
Well, be careful on that thing. Brooks, I have a question for you, but it's not really on the topic of, you know, the current state of, you know.
That's okay. You're allowed.
What's going on in the country? Can I just cut to the chase?
Absolutely.
I have a question for you. I have a question that concerns HAARP.
Okay.
And I know that it's a technology that you do know something about. Nick Begich says you do.
That's correct.
But my question is, are you aware of the work of Dutch Sense?
No, I'm not. What is he?
This is he's just an independent guy who has been posting YouTube videos for almost 2 years now. And what he looks for are, what's going on with the USGS, with the volcanic and earthquake activity around the planet, and then following weather patterns using, he basically, when he posts a video, he will show on his video, like the next rad map and the, I don't know all of those terms, but like NOAA or radar, etc., right? And he picks up anomalies. He's been doing this for a while. And in fact, what he claims is that there are these certain radar patterns that he picks up that look like circles, flashes of circles, clouds that look like they've been pulsed into a circle. And he represents those as harp rings.
Interesting.
And he's made a correlation between picking up these anomalies and then severe weather outbreaks within 24 to 72 hours afterwards. For instance, if you went on his site, you would see that he picked up a bunch of these rings and flashes about 24 hours before the Joplin tornado. Last July, he started picking up, looking at, I don't know if it was Google Maps combined with some kind of, USGS, but he started picking up these plumes that were erupting out of, obviously very extinct lava volcano fields in the southwestern United States, Nevada, Utah, California. And then he got into some trouble. I mean, his site got taken down, and, there was, basically, especially when he started reporting on the plumes, because he couldn't figure out what they were. And some of the other kind of official sites were saying that these plumes were just forest fires that were burning, except that when you went in on Google Maps, really, it was in a rock bed, right? There's no trees to be burning. But the big question is, because there's a lot of controversy, and so my question was, like, do you think that harp activity can appear on a radar screen, whether it's a circle or a flash? I mean, I just wondered if that was something that you've ever thought about, or because I don't know where to go to verify that this is even a possibility.
Well, there are different frequencies, radar and harp, and I guess the question I would have is how does he detect the radar? Because if he's just looking at weather radar images and going around the country from one weather map to another, or maybe NOAA sites using the weather maps to or weather radar displays to gather his information, that'd be one question. And the other is if you're using Google Earth and you're looking at the planet, these a lot of the images that you get on Google Earth are quite dated. Some of them will be months old.
Well, no, that I
real time.
Yeah, that I realize. No, I think on the plumes, I think he was looking at satellite imagery because he seems to employ. I just wish that I was more, educated, not educated, but knowledgeable with regard to all of the sites he goes to. But if you go onto his, his WordPress blog where he posts all these videos, he always puts the link to what he's using, and he always says, now we're going to go look at, this particular, we're going to go to this site. And when he's doing one of these analyses, he will go to three or four or five different sites that are public access sites. I mean, he's not like tapping into top secret.
And his name is Dutch Scent?
Well, that's a moniker. Dutch Sinse, but when his channel got pulled off of YouTube for a while, he opened up a blog called Since Dutch, so he reversed it. I will get you the exact. It's a WordPress blog. It is sincedutch.wordpress.com.
Well, I will definitely see if he'll come on the program because I, all that stuff's interesting to me. And, you know, we talked about the Iranian earthquakes that happened, two 6.5-plus earthquakes back-to-back in different cities, just devastating these towns. Maybe they're bombarding Iran with HAARP right now and destabilizing the tectonics over there.
Was this today?
Yes.
The Iranian earthquakes?
Right.
Oh, I've been on other research myself, so I didn't know about that.
Yeah, it's brand new. I can't hardly find any articles on it, but evidently emergency support groups are on the way to try to help them out.
Well
interesting stuff.
Here's the thing about Dutch Sense. Let's see if he's posted any of it. Yes, 8/11, 6.4 and 6.3 earthquake strike Iran Middle East.
There you go.
He's already got it on his site.
Interesting. I wonder if he picked up surrounding those.
And then he said, here are stats for both, and he's got a link to earthquake.usgs.gov, and then he's got, you know, all of the details of each quake. You know, northwestern Iran, 20 kilometers west-southwest of Ahar, 60 kilometers east-northeast of Tabriz. Yeah, he's got all that posted.
Interesting. Well, that's great. I love to have people that are on top.
Yeah, so anyway, if you go check it out, because I'm really, you know, because I basically, I'm curious about it, and I have a good friend who I was telling about, and of course, his response back was, how does Dutch Sense know that these anomalies he's picking up have anything to do with HAARP? Is he just calling them HAARP rings because he's decided that that's what they are?
Yeah,
or does he
probably
have some information?
HAARP has some signatures that go with it. One thing is that they broadcast in ham ranges, and hams monitor this stuff all the time. So, like, for instance, when the earthquake happened in Haiti, and the birds died in Arkansas and various things, I contact my ham buddies and ask them, did they pick up a HAARP signature? When they say no, that means that HAARP was not broadcasting. The other signature is, if the atmosphere is just the right conditions, people notice a sort of lavender aurora as HAARP is being irradiated in the area. And if they're sending ELF overwaves on top of that, they can set up resonance in the ground. And literally, the resonator can search for the resonant frequency of the strata and get it vibrating. Now, it may take 5 to 6 or 7 hours for that vibration to build in momentum, but it can take an unstable area of tectonics and make it trigger an earthquake.
Correct. What about the notion of HAARP being used to either intensify a hurricane or a tornado, or move the jet stream, or all of these things that have to do with weather modification?
Yes, I did a History Channel special on weather warfare, and I built a miniature model of HAARP with a cloud chamber. And I got a cloud stabilized inside the chamber, which we got on camera. I turned the HAARP on, and in less than 2 seconds, that cloud completely dissipated inside that chamber. You could actually watch the water vapor inside the chamber move with the frequency. So that's how it works. I did it again, by the way, for Jesse Ventura on his conspiracy theories program, the debut episode of that. So it does work. And here's how it works in real life. They will grab the ionosphere above the area that they want to manipulate, and they will push it out into space using HAARP. Now, when they push it, they push it 60 to 80 kilometers out into space. It creates a void, which the jet stream, the stratosphere and jet stream, then move in to fill. And that's how they steer these storms. So they can bring weather patterns together, intensifying storms, or they can actually steer storms by moving the stratosphere out of the way.
Right. I actually saw this on a Nick Begich video and a Tom Bearden video.
Well, Nick Begich
pushed the ionosphere.
Is the expert on mind control. These ELF waves can actually entrain the human psyche and human physiology, and can cause sleeplessness, nightmares, tremors, convulsions or organ failure, all kinds of stuff. He's the real expert on that.
Yes, in this video I watched, it was an old one from 2006. It's on YouTube. It's an hour and something long, and that's where he mentioned that you were the person who had, maybe first identified HARP being used for, is it called tomography, where you're looking for mineral oil deposits using HARP?
Yes. Right. Yep.
Instead of the old-fashioned, blow up something with dynamite and see what the seismograph says?
That's correct. I actually developed earth tomography back in the mid-80s, and he contacted me in 1997, and we did the video Holes in Heaven. This was with Wendy Robbins directing and Paula Randall Jones as the producer. So it's still a top seller out there. And I understand Paula's going to do an updated film before too long.
So, Brooks, just before I let you go, because I know you've got to get back on your subject matter here, but do you think that it's even feasible that some of this drought that's occurring, while it may be a natural cycle, may also be being manipulated?
My personal opinion is yes, we're not the only ones with HARP. There are other countries with HARPs, and it is a weapon without fingerprints. So I would say yes, I'm suspect of it. And not just the weirdness, locally here and there, but it's globally. Like, it snowed in Johannesburg. Now, yes, it's wintertime there, but it never snows in Johannesburg. It snowed in Sydney, Australia.
Right.
We lost an entire year of wheat crop in Russia. We're about to lose a lot of crops in the Midwest in the U.S. from this drought.
Right. And last year it was Argentina.
And last year we had a record winter, if you'll remember. Record cold, record snowfalls. I flew from Phoenix to Washington State last summer. And I've done this many, many times. I have never seen it green, but all the mountains, all the desert floors and everything were green. All the lakes were full. All the snow was over all the mountains and everything. I was going, wow, this is amazing. I've never seen it this way.
Wow. So if someone was going to send you an email, Brooks, how would they do that?
Well, the easiest way is bagnew@x2-radio.com. I do have all my...
bagnew.
At x2-radio.com.
x2-radio.com. x2-radio.
Or you go to x2-radio.com and all that contact information is there as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
For your time you've given me. I'll call you again sometime.
Yeah.
Hey, if you go look at his site, are you going to chat about any of this?
Well, maybe not tonight.
I've
got
worthwhile?
A pretty packed schedule, but I'm definitely...
No, not tonight. No, not tonight.
Yes, I am.
I usually listen to you on Sunday night.
Should I tell
okay,
him?
Okay, I hope you get in touch with him and, you have him on your show.
Okay, I will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is
bye
how it's
for
done.
Now.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening. Yes, the rare snowfall. Here it is. People slowly came outside despite the cold wind Tuesday across South Africa, pointed their mobile phone cameras to the sky, and opened their mouths to taste a rare snowfall that fell on much of the country. The snow began Tuesday morning, part of an extreme cold snap now biting into a nation still in its winter months. By mid-afternoon, officials recorded snowfall across most of South Africa. However, forecasters acknowledge snow remains so unusual that they typically aren't prepared to provide details about snowfall in the nation. The snow closed some roads and at least one high-altitude pass. The snowfall also closed several border posts in the country. As the snow fell, workers at offices in Johannesburg rushed outside. Some twirled and danced as the flakes fell. Snow angels, all that stuff. The snow grew heavier in the afternoon in Johannesburg, covering rooftops and slicking roads. In Pretoria, the country's capital, flurries filled the sky during a visit by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Ah, now we know the source of the snow. I'm just kidding. It was the first snowfall there since 1968. 44 years it's been since it snowed there. Amazing stuff. Hey, let's go back to the phones. Raleen from Los Angeles, welcome to the program.
Robert.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Better. How are you, good? Well, it's not snowing out here. It's hot out here in Los Angeles.
It's hot out here in Charlotte as well.
Is it? Anyway, what do you think? A couple things. These are kind of big. One thing was I read in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that's saying that this recession is the worst since 1930.
Well, it's actually a little worse than that. I'll tell you why. We always have a post-war recession. And after World War I, we had two recessions. We recovered mildly from one, and then the second one hit, similar to what we're going through right now. We had a tremendous amount of job loss, but the stock market was going nuts. Nobody could lose money. I mean, just roaring, just like it is today.
So you think that this will pass soon?
No, I don't. I think what will happen is that because we have a more rare situation here. Back in the early 1900s, early 20th century, we had numerous very strong currencies in the world. And after the Versailles Treaty and all the reparations were settled on Germany, and many large industrial banks and industrialists invested in Germany, got it back and up and on its feet, financed their war, and then financed our war to fight their war. There were a lot of strong currencies in the world. Now, today, we have condensed those currencies down to four. There is the euro. There is the yuan, which is the Chinese form of money, which is artificially held off of market value. It's their value set by the government. There's the dollar, and then there's the British pound. So those are basically the four main currencies in the world. And it's not going to take much for that to condense to one. And the reason they're trying to do that is because the guys that are trading money back and forth, like George Soros and others, they're troublemakers. They're not part of the elite. And what's happened now is these super fast computers are doing money trades, sometimes 30 to 50 of them a month, slowly escalating the money back and forth to make huge amounts of cash. But this is, okay, there's no value in it. So once it gets to such a high level, it has to crash. There's no way around it. There are several trillion Iraqi dinars out there that have been off the market since the first Gulf War. All those dinars are legitimate. They've been sold by banks. People bought them from their banks. They're holding on to them. Trillions and trillions of dinars. Those are long overdue to what's called revaluate, RV, which means that we link it back to the U.S. dollar. Some say it could link in at around $3. I say it's going to be more like 10 or 12 cents, but it might not happen at all. And if the Iraqi dinar collapses or they issue a new dinar the way Kuwait did, it will cause a chain reaction that will cause global currency meltdown. That's why I tell people to get their cash out of the bank.
So, okay, going on to that, you know, you're talking about the Chinese. I also read an article, well, I didn't read, I heard an article on PRI Radio, BBC's Worldwide, saying that the U.S. corporations are having a lot of trouble doing business in Africa because the Chinese corporations are going in there and they can offer better deals and they're backed by the Chinese government.
That's correct. And we're having a hard time doing business here because all of the venture capital that will go into small business, especially emerging technologies like electric vehicles and electric batteries and such like that, solar, mm-hmm. it's all Chinese money.
Right. And the Chinese are going to control it in one way or another.
Yeah, and you realize that, that sovereign nations cannot allow that to happen.
Right.
We're not going to allow all of
it. Won't be sovereign.
Yeah, exactly.
And let's see, what was the other things out here in the West? Ah, the mayor of a place called California City, which is out in the Antelope Valley, which is near Lancaster, where my friend Nicole lives.
Uh-huh.
The mayor was accused of sexual harassment. So he's got a little bit of a problem out there, the mayor of California City. I talked to one of the girls out there named Rachel. No, Becky was her name. And they're trying to pretty much push away all the telephone calls now because it was in the newspaper. And they don't want to have to hassle with that.
Well,
we got one crooked politician might have a problem.
Got a lot of cities. Was he harassing a male or a female?
No, my understanding was it was a female. But he's denying all the charges, of course.
Of course.
You know, it's going to take some time for them to melt it down and put it in a pot to see what it does, you know?
Well, I understand that Janet Napolitano is also being sued for sexual harassment of her male staffers.
Wow. So it's going around. And doesn't matter.
Tension out there, you know. People are hungry. They want to keep a good job, but they don't want to put up with everything to keep that job. I mean, they'll lose their dignity. They'll clean the toilets. They'll work overtime unpaid. But, you know, people draw a limit. They draw a line, and they say, look, enough is enough. You can't treat me this way just because I work for you.
Right. There was an article in the Daily News, which is a paper in the San Fernando Valley where I live in L.A. County, or L.A. City. There was an article that said that job hiring is up, but so is unemployment. So, in the article, it kind of explained it, but here's the way I caught it. A lot of the jobs have been lost. They're high-paid jobs. They're also benefits. Those jobs that people have been laid off or fired or were for whatever reason. Now what they've created is a lot of jobs that are minimum wage. The problem is people here in Los Angeles cannot live on $8 an hour jobs unless they move a full lot of people in an apartment.
Yeah, that's true. I know that the cost of living is very high there still, even though prices have come way back. You know, as luck would have it, this week I actually met with two congressmen and two senators, and they asked me what I thought would re-stimulate the economy because, you know, I'm obviously a small businessman and I have ideas about stuff like this. And I responded very quickly, not with a 57-point plan, a two-point plan for getting jobs going again in America. You want to hear it?
Sure.
All right. The first one is that you have to eliminate capital gains tax for investments in emerging technologies with companies that have a market cap of less than $100 million. These are small to medium-sized businesses. The problem has been such corruption with the stimulus business because all the money was given to billion-dollar multinational corporations. All they did is their executives big fat bonuses, kick back a few hundred thousand or a few million back to the campaign that gave them the money, and that was the end of that. So that's the first thing, is you have to eliminate the capital gains tax so that venture capitalists and investors can put money into emerging technologies, leave it there for 3 years, then they can pull their profits out and not pay any taxes on it. We got about $5 trillion.
It's an incentive program for small business.
Yes. Well, it is not really an incentive program for small business. It's an incentive program for investors to invest in small business because it's risky.
Yeah, right. To invest in small business.
Right. Now, if they make a capital gains, they get killed. or they have to leave it in there for at least 5 years, and nobody right. trusts the government for 5 years.
Right. A lot of people I know right now won't trust them for a minute.
That's right. Now, the second one, the second point is just as important as the first. In fact, the first won't work unless you do the second. And this is what I told them. Listen closely. You must take the market makers and brokers off the trading floor the day after they fail to deliver a stock. It's called naked shorting. When right. a company naked shorts a stock, it's a phantom share. The share does not exist. They don't deliver it. What they do is they right. short the stock and make it go down in price so they actually never have to buy it. They just get exactly. your money for the stock. Now, what will stop that?
Back in 2003 or 4, somewhere in that realm, my wife and I were doing a little bit of day trading for a short time. We got screwed bad on that naked stock.
Well, you can short a stock legally. You can buy the stock right. and short it and let it go down and, you know.
That's a lot of times we play all kinds of games. And they do very well at their games.
Buy low, sell high kind of stuff. Or you can buy options. But right. this is not options. These are people that are actually selling shares.
Yeah, they're trading and selling stocks that they don't even have. They don't even exist.
That's correct. They're supposed to be borrowed shares. But the shares never existed. And right. these naked short traders are not only domestic, they're offshore. And they've killed over 6,000 small businesses in the last 42 months. 6,000 small businesses. So what we have to do is
wow.
we have to, you got to make it automatic in the computer program. You fail to deliver a stock by the close of business today, and you cannot trade tomorrow. Now, what
that's
that will
lot.
Do, it will allow small business to sell stock and raise their own money.
Right. Well, I mean, we got hammered by a few different kind of questionable traders. And the deal was, you get these letters in the mail, class action suit, okay, and this thing law firm is going to take it on, blah, 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 blah. We throw them in the trash can because the chances you're going to recover anything is nil. I mean, those companies are trading like that and they're doing false trades or whatever they're doing wrong. Chances are, 9 times out of 10, nothing ever happens to them.
Oh, it's 10 times out of 10. Also,
okay.
in the news this week.
Some point. Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, exactly.
The government is not going to prosecute.
Isn't that? That just stunned
unbelievable.
That stunned me. The biggest bank heist in the history of the world. And they had 150 people, more than 150 people indicted, and they decided not yeah. to prosecute any of them.
Right. They decided not to do a thing. But yet, the Justice Department goes in the Gibson guitar in Tennessee and confiscates all their computers over wood that was supposedly illegal.
That's correct. That's exactly correct. Gibson guitar.
They go after Gibson, a U.S. company, but they won't go after Goldman Sachs for all these bad trades.
Well, see, Roland, what you're missing here is that Goldman Sachs is represented by Holder's old law firm.
Oh, wow.
And he's not going to be attorney general forever. He's got to have a job when he gets out of, you know, the Department of Justice.
Yeah, he's got to keep people happy.
Exactly.
So that was represented by Holder's old law firm?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
I heard he was being investigated, but that'll never go anywhere either.
Wrong-o. He was convicted of contempt of Congress, and tomorrow, I covered this first hour, tomorrow ISSA is suing him in federal court in D.C., and he could go to prison.
Good for ISSA. They're getting Eric Holder about time. I'm all for him.
Well, if they can get him and, you know, make him a felon, then he's taken out of the system. And I'm
hoping. I just ran I ran into a guard that worked at one of the prisons here in California last night.
Yeah.
I was out in an area called Green Valley. He was driving into Palmdale. He's at the beach in Ventura with his family. He told me that Leroy Baca, our sheriff for L.A. County, is a two-time felon on domestic violence against wives. That's our sheriff cannot even carry a gun.
Wow.
How's that? My friend Bill spoke. He was in Hollywood this summer. He found the article. He emailed them to me.
That totally blows my mind.
How about this? Bill Lagosa. He had a deal where Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, back in the day when Clinton's administration was in, he was a state senator. He and another state senator asked to pardon a coke dealer, and I believe the guy was from south of the border originally. Anyway, they got a pardon for this guy that was a coke dealer. Now, here's the thing I put up on the web. The people that took over my house, which was the Mongol bikers, also the Vagos that molested the rape Nicole. Those two guys are basically Mexican mafia. So here's the thing, but if Villaraigosa is tied to the Mexican mafia through this helping of the coke dealer back in the Clinton administration, and if the bikers are definitely Mexican mafia, and I've gone off on all that, there's a Mexican mafia controlling Southern California.
That blows my mind. I mean, organized crime is so organized right now.
Oh, very. These guys are sharp. You know, Nicole was sold to a syndicate when she was young. And so I went off to this guy, Albert, with Leroy Baca, okay, for running the syndicate in the San Fernando Valley and also his buddy running it out in Minecatch. That's where Nicole got hooked up with it. She had no chance, but since she was a kid, she was put up for adoption. I have a lot of respect for her mother, who was a speed freak, but put her up for adoption because she knew she couldn't handle it. Her dad, who was an Army vet like myself, Jim Morton, lives over in Dallas. I sent her to his mother's funeral, her grandmother, who was also adopted, his mother. I sent Nicole over there with her son, Hunter, for the funeral. I couldn't get her there in time to see his grandma. She said that grandma and the grandpa, Russell Lancaster Sr. of Burbank, were her two favorite relatives of all time. That's because nobody in between ever helped her until she met me. Now, here's the question, Bert. Since she was in a syndicate, and I don't know which syndicate, but there's a lot of different ones, why is it that all these people that knew this woman for 30 years plus never helped her until she met me 4 years ago?
I have no idea. Sounds like a complex story.
Is it afraid or part of it? There's only two answers. They're either afraid of it or they're part of it.
Exactly.
There's
well,
in between. It's white and black.
I'd say probably both.
Some information this week.
But it's never part of it.
How's that for a little bit of information this week? Am I keeping up on my news stories?
Yeah, you're keeping us appraised of the lowdown in California, and I appreciate it. The hour's up. I got to take a break.
You have a wonderful week.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks for the call.
Sure, sir. Have a good week.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay, Earth Explorers, let's take a quick break. That hour ran a little bit long. No worries. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
now it's time to go away. Goodbye. Goodbye, Milky Way.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. You want to do something interesting tonight if you've got clear skies. Run out and see if you can see the Perseid meteor showers. Should be more active more toward the early morning hours than late night, but still 100 meteors per hour. Liable to see something interesting for sure. Please join us if you want to, 888-429-5471. Or you can click on the Droid app at xsquaredradio.com and you can listen on your cell phone via Bluetooth and enjoy the program that way. We always aim to please at BBS Radio, the largest webcast radio network on the web. And X Squared Radio is often the number one program on that network because of you. The listeners, we appreciate you so much. I was talking to one of my friends in New York, Brian Jennings, the other day. Lots of interesting stuff about the Iraqi dinar. Maybe he'll call in tonight. Don't forget about the food investor. Go to xsquaredradio.com. The banner is right there at the top on the right-hand side by the affiliates, list of affiliates there. Yes, it's good to invest in stuff. but it's even better to invest in food. The Food Investor, my friends Scott Barzee and Danny Morris out in Utah founded the company. Food is absolutely delicious and nutritious, and it will last for 30 years. Go on, set it, forget it, put it in a pack, and you're ready to go. You don't have to worry about FEMA taking care of you. Because the weather is doing some strange, very, very strange thing. We mentioned in the last hour that it snowed in Johannesburg, all over South Africa. Also, July was the hottest month in the continental United States on record, ever, beating the hottest month in the devastating Dust Bowl summer of 1936. It was also the warmest January to July period since modern record-keeping began in 1895. And the warmest 12-month period, eclipsing the last record set just a month ago. And that's from the NOAA. Those of you that don't think global warming is occurring, that don't think climate change is upon us, data doesn't lie. This is the fourth time in as many months that U.S. temperatures broke the hottest 12-month record. The average temperature for July across the contiguous 48 states was 77.6 degrees or 3.3 degrees above the 20th century average. The previous warmest July in 1936 averaged 77.4 degrees. Along with the record heat, drought covered nearly 63% of the 48 contiguous states. I'm sure you've seen the maps on your weather channel and TV. This is where 75% of the U.S. corn and soybean crops are grown, by the way. Analysts expect the drought, the worst since 1956, will yield the smallest corn crop in 6 years, meaning record high prices and tight supplies. It would be the third year of declining corn production despite large plantings. The government will make its first estimate of the fall harvest on Friday of this week. It already has cut projections for corn yields by 12% due to hot, dry weather in the farm belt. Drought and heat fed each other in July. The hotter it gets, the drier it gets, the hotter it gets, says Jake Crouch, a scientist at NOAA's National Climatic Data Center. What made this year different from the Dust Bowl summer of 1936 was nighttime temperatures, he said. In the Dust Bowl years, the warmth was largely driven by daytime highs. This July, the record heat was also pushed by warm nighttime temperatures. The overnight lows weren't that low. The president has been asked to pass a farm disaster aid bill to flow to livestock producers. The drought triggered a surge in the prices for U.S. corn and soybeans to record highs last month, as if our food inflation isn't already outrageous, 400% on some products, with values rising above 50% and 30% respectively. Sharp price increases in the United States, the world's largest grower and exporter of these two commodity crops, have sparked global concern over potential increases in food prices after a similar surge led to food riots in dozens of countries in 2008. And that was because so much corn was going to the making of ethanol before alternative sources were found. It caused the demand for corn to go up. Farmers were planting corn on corn on corn instead of rotating their crops. And the booming business of 2008 and 2009 was the building of corn silos to store the corn that would be used for fuel. Now, are you aware that the Aurora Borealis actually makes a sound? It does. The Aurora Borealis sounds that have been described in folk tales and by wilderness wanderers are formed about 70 meters above ground level in this measured case that they did in this area. Team located the sound sources by installing three separate microphones in an observation site where the auroral sounds were recorded. They then compared sounds captured by the microphones and determined the location of the sound source. The aurora borealis was seen at the observation site. The simultaneous measurements of the geomagnetic disturbances made by the Finnish Meteorological Institute showed a typical pattern of the Northern Lights episodes. Let's see here. Professor Unto Laine of the Aalto University. In the past, researchers thought that the aurora borealis was too far away for people to hear the sounds it made. This is true. However, our research proves that the sources of the sounds that are associated with the aurora borealis we see is likely caused by the same energetic particles from the sun that create the northern lights far away in the sky. These particles, or the geomagnetic disturbance produced by them, seem to create sound much closer to the ground than we thought. Details about how the auroral sounds are created are still a mystery. The sounds do not occur regularly when the northern lights are seen. The recorded unamplified sounds can be similar to crackles or muffled bangs, which last for only a short period of time. Other people who have heard the auroral sounds have described them as a distant noise and sputter, kind of like a live wire on the ground. Because of these different descriptions, researchers suspect that there are several mechanisms behind the formation of these auroral sounds. These sounds are so soft that one has to listen very carefully to hear them and to distinguish them from the ambient noise. Kind of reminds me a little bit of, I know this is going to really sound strange, but you remember when John the Baptist baptized Jesus in the River Jordan, came up out of the water, and certain individuals heard the voice of God come out of heaven as the dove landed on his shoulder saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." And many of the Zoroastrians, John included, said, you know, basically, "Behold the Lamb of God." Other people, though, said that they heard a sound very similar to rushing waters or the wind. And so it wasn't intelligible by everyone. Many critics of that particular passage say that only those individuals that were in tune with the Spirit could understand the language, almost a telepathic message that was coming through. But perhaps it was this almost unintelligible, very still, small voice that came from the light. One of the big arguments that has been happening in the news lately is the argument over whether CERN has discovered the Higgs boson or not, the God particle, as many people call it. And it has been incorrectly interpreted as a particle that contains, you know, all the information relative to the creation. That's why it's called the God particle. I wanted to clarify something before I read this section on quantum matter. Higgs was vindicated by some of the information that's been gathered by CERN. But the Higgs event that actually made the Big Bang happen, theoretically, because you have to think about all the matter in the entire universe being jammed into one micro speck, and the mother of all black holes. With all of this matter jammed into one place, not even light could escape. No radiation of any kind escapes, just the gravitational waves of space-time being warped by such a huge amount of matter in one place. Something happened to make the whole thing explode. And the easiest way to describe it is sort of like taking a ball of industrial strength Velcro and, you know, rolling it up and tightening it down into just as tight a ball as you can possibly get it. Now, you know, the theory of Velcro is that you've got these hard plastic hooks and then you've got these random loops of of hard fiber that get hooked in the hooks, and that's how Velcro works. And you could tear it loose, but once it makes a connection, it takes an outside effort to make it come apart. The Higgs event was a little bit like one of the elastic portions of a ball of Velcro suddenly snapping with enough force to cause a chain reaction to cause the entire ball of Velcro to suddenly explode apart and fly all over the living room spontaneously. Yes, I know, it sounds a little, you know, outlandish. And if you read The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 1, Chapter 2, or if you read Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, there's a chapter in there called The Big Bang Never Happened. Because in the book, we take the perspective of a photon of the universe in which time slows down to nothing because distance slows down to nothing. Everything is local, which means that the Big Bang actually never happened from the perspective of the photon. There's no difference whatsoever. It doesn't take any time at all for the photon to get from Arcturus to Earth, in other words, because it's traveling at the speed of light. At the speed of light, time slows down to nothing. So therefore, there is no path. There is no distance. Everything is local. So maybe the Higgs boson is just a perspective of consciousness. But with headlines proclaiming the discovery of a particle consistent with the Higgs boson, particle physics has captured the imagination of the world. But this is only one puzzle seemingly solved in physics. The team of Dartmouth physicists delved into another enigmatic particle predicted in 1937 by the brilliant Italian physicist Ettore Majorana. Majorana is a mysterious particle that may exist on the boundary of matter and antimatter, curiously, as it is thought to be both a material particle and its own corresponding antiparticle. Matter and antimatter have long been a cause célèbre in both scientific and science fiction circles. When matter and antimatter collide, they typically disappear in a burst of energy. Not so with the Majoranas, thought to be stable and robust. By virtue of these attributes, this mysterious Majorana can be instrumental in solving other mysteries, perhaps even redefining the nature of the universe. Some astrophysicists suggest that Majorana particles comprise the elusive dark matter thought to form more than 70% of the known universe. Despite intensive searches, no elemental particle has so far been found that is a Majorana particle. Over the past few years, however, condensed matter physicists have realized that Majorana could collectively form as quasi-particles built out of ordinary electrons in matter under appropriate physical conditions. Thanks to their reputed robustness, these Majorana quasi-particles are believed to be suitable as the building blocks of quantum computers. Though theoretical at the moment, quantum computers have the potential to be orders of magnitude more powerful than our current digital devices, as envisioned. They would have immense capacities to store information and the ability to solve important computational problems with unprecedented efficiency. Yeah, that's what we said when the 386 came out. Wow, that machine was fast. Yeah, right. Yeah, the computer I have right now in front of me makes that one look crazy. I have a solid-state hard drive, which makes this computer even faster. The challenge we have is that we work with the microscopic, not something like stars and galaxies that you can see and relate to, explained Lorenzo Viola, a professor of physics at Dartmouth College, who co-authored a recent paper published in Physical Review Letters. I tell my students we are so big, and this is so microscopic, and we just don't have enough imagination to visualize things at this level. But if we could be tiny as an electron, we could understand the quantum world much better. In the paper, Professor Viola and her colleagues suggest a locale where Majoranas may be found. They propose a theoretical model to support Majorana quasi-particles forming a class of exotic materials known as topological superconductors. Though they've never actually found a particle, so they haven't actually made the superconductor, so they're just imagining these. The team describes the topological superconductors as having a split personality. Their outside surfaces conduct electricity like metal, but inside they are superconductors. The scientists hypothesize that Majoranas could occur only on the surface or on the interior-exterior interface. Remarkably, unlike existing proposals, Professor Viola and her colleagues' proposal requires only conventional superconductivity in the bulk of the material and no application of strong magnetic fields, preserving the important fundamental symmetry of time reversal. The hunt for Majoranas is currently underway in laboratories across the world. No one has found one yet. As additional experimental evidence is collected and scrutinized, Professor Viola believes that S-wave topological superconductors will provide another rich arena in which to explore Majorana physics and further uncover the new fundamental properties of topological quantum matter. Great inroads being made there. First, you have to image or imagine the particle existing, and then the hunt is on. Then you know what you're looking for. Maybe, just maybe, you're manifesting the particle into existence, which is even more exciting. Meanwhile, if we take time, we go way, way back, like my good friend Michael Cremo does in his Forbidden Archaeology. We discover, as we look at Antarctica, 52 million years ago. Now that's ancient history. An iceberg floating near the Antarctic coast has been drilled. Given the predicted rise in global temperatures in the coming decades, climate scientists are particularly interested in warm periods that occurred in the geological past. Knowledge of past episodes of global warmth can be used to better understand the relationship between climate change, variations in atmospheric carbon dioxide, and the reaction of Earth's biosphere in which we live. The study, published in the journal Nature, shows that tropical vegetation, including palms and relatives of today's tropical baobab trees, was growing on the coast of Antarctica 52 million years ago. These results highlight the extreme contrast between modern and past climatic conditions on Antarctica and the extent of global warmth during periods of elevated atmospheric carbon dioxide levels. Now, that being said, excuse me while I take a sip. That being said, we don't know what Earth's alignment to the sun was 52 million years ago. Maybe we were aligned more straight up and down instead of tilted 23 degrees on our axis, which means there are no seasons. It's the same year-round. The sun doesn't go south and north, south and north. There are no equinoxes. There are no solstices. It's in the same line all the time, which would mean the ice caps would melt. It would mean that tropical conditions could be pushed way, way up to the extreme latitudes. Around 52 million years ago, this is what they discovered. The concentration of the greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, which I might add, it's rather doubtful that that even is a greenhouse gas, in our atmosphere was more than twice as high as today. Yes, it's true. Even without SUVs, it was there. If the current carbon dioxide emissions continue unabated due to the burning of fossil fuels, carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere as they existed in the distant past are likely to be achieved within a few 100 years, said lead author Professor Jörg Pross, a paleoclimatologist at the Goethe University. Get that. And it's already starting. By studying naturally occurring climate warming periods in the geological past, our knowledge of the mechanisms and processes in the climate system increases. This contributes enormously to improving our understanding of current human-induced global warming. 52-million-year-old palm pollen left, and pollen from ancestors of today, baobab trees, found by the team. The scientists analyzed rock samples from drill cores on the seabed, which were obtained off the coast of Wilkes Land, Antarctica, as part of the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program. The rock samples are between 53 and 46 million years old and contain fossil pollen and spores that are known to originate from the Antarctic coastal region. The researchers were thus able to reconstruct the local vegetation on Antarctica and accordingly interpret the presence of tropical and subtropical rainforests covering the coastal region 52 million years ago. The scientists' evaluations show that the winter temperatures on the Wilkes Land coast of Antarctica were warmer than 10 degrees Celsius at the time. That's about that's pretty close to 50 degrees, despite 3 months of polar night. The continental interior, however, was noticeably cooler, with the climate supporting the growth of temperate rainforests characterized by southern beech and araucaria trees of the type common in New Zealand today. Additional evidence of extremely mild temperatures was provided by analysis of organic compounds that were produced by soil bacteria populating the soils along the Antarctic coast. The findings also imply that the temperature difference between the low latitudes and high southern latitudes during the greenhouse phase 52 million years ago was significantly smaller than previously thought. And they're learning more as time goes on. Now, for them to say that the rate of increase of CO2 in the atmosphere relative to human activity will drive us to similar levels of CO2 in a few hundred years is not only dramatic, it's shocking, because that rate of increase is unpredictable. If we continue at our present rate, it may be a few hundred years. But as you have already seen, and believe me, it's so hard to resist this, there is a push, there is a hunger, there is a fear that we are going to run out of oil. As you have already seen, the price of gasoline is back up to $4 a gallon. Yes, I know, it goes up and down like 36 cents. But before the end of the summer, you will see $4 a gallon gas by this time, by Christmas this year. It will have passed $4 again. What's making it go up? Good question. What's making it go up are several events that are happening around the world, not the least of which are the tensions around the Straits of Hormuz. But we recently had a U.S. destroyer today collide with an oil supertanker. No one knows what the damage is there. We had a refinery on the west coast of America catch fire. We don't know what the damage is there. We have Venezuela now beginning to sell most of its oil to China. We don't know what the impact on our markets will be from that. And now we have India, which is ramping up a dozen new airports, building roads, and manufacturing vehicles at record pace. And I admit that there's a strong market for electric vehicles there, and hopefully they go that way. But their usage of oil is climbing. And I have it on good authority that even the Nigerians are trying to sell more oil outside of OPEC, because OPEC, you know, restricts your production in order to keep the price high. But all the countries have what they call off-OPEC oil that they try to sell 10, 30, 40 million barrels a month at off OPEC prices, discounts, in order to get more revenue into the country, because some of these countries are revenue starved and oil is, you know, a major export. So they have to do it in order to survive. And the buyers of this oil are risking everything, because the buyers are usually large refineries and they have to watch their P's and Q's. The point is that there's a fever to drill, baby, drill. As you know, presumptive Republican candidate for president, Mitt Romney, chose his VP yesterday, as we had predicted many times on this program, that it would be Paul Ryan. An excellent choice, by the way. A very accomplished accounting brain, able to understand the budget, which is very difficult for one person to do. Usually takes a whole office to understand the budget, and then they have arguments over aspects of it. And I'm sure that the arguments are just beginning. But the couched comments that we were going to go after all the natural resources of the United States and exploit them to their fullest to become completely energy independent is quite frightening on three different levels. Number one is that if we go after all of the petroleum and gas resources that we have in the country, it will cause a decrease in the price of oil. We know this because once this extra oil is put into the system, the price begins to drop and we can no longer use it as a weapon against China. We have to keep the price of fuel up, the price of oil up, in order to slow China's growth down. Also, one other pressure that a lot of people don't realize is oil has to stay at or above $100 a barrel, or Russia is looking for a place to go to war. That's how Russia makes most of its money, oil exporting. That's why oil has to be at or above that price. If it gets below that, Russia cannot make the kind of revenues that it needs nationally to keep itself afloat, and so it looks for other resources. The other thing is that the burning of this oil, which is some crazy thing that we're still doing in the 21st century, blows my mind. The burning of petroleum is creating a tremendous amount of CO2 globally. And although our vehicles could be much, much more efficient, 30 miles per gallon is ridiculously low compared to the technology that we have available. We could easily produce 60, 70, and even 90 mile per gallon vehicles. No, you would not be able to do 0 to 60 in 5 seconds any longer. But who needs to do that? Who needs 385 horsepower under the hood? Who needs to be able to light the back tires up? Who needs to be able to drift sideways like we show in the television commercials? Who drives like that? Not legally. If you live in Los Angeles, you rarely get a chance to drive like that. Even late at night, the traffic is terrible on the 405 or the Santa Monica Freeway. There are times when you can drive fast, but the revenuers are going to be out there, and they're going to hit you, and then the insurance company is going to spank that rash for another couple years. So who can afford it? The point is, we could build vehicles that could make our oil usage a fraction of what it is today for transportation. Oil's good for all kinds of other stuff. Ink, plastics, chemicals, fibers, coatings, all kinds of stuff. It doesn't have to be burned. It doesn't have to be turned into CO2, which is where most of it goes right now. Also, a recent discovery, artifacts from a border cave 1 through 8 in Africa. Artifacts point to modern culture 44,000 years ago. That's right. No, Earth wasn't created 6,000 years ago. I know that's what it says, but maybe another Earth was created 6,000 years ago and merged with this Earth. But this modern culture existed 44,000 years ago. Results by the team, consisting of scientists from South Africa, France, Italy, Norway, the USA, and Britain, are published in two papers online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. You'll like these papers if you like reading archaeological papers. I'll read you some of it here. The dating and analysis of archaeological material discovered at Border Cave in South Africa has allowed us to demonstrate that many elements of material culture that characterize the lifestyle of San hunter-gatherers in southern Africa were part of the culture and technology of the inhabitants of this site 44,000 years ago, said Dr. Lucinda Backwell, a senior researcher in the paleoanthropology at the Wits University Bernard Price Institute for Paleontological Research and co-author of both papers. A key question in human evolution is when, in prehistory, human cultures similar to ours emerged. Until now, most archaeologists believe that the oldest traces of San hunter-gatherer culture in southern Africa dates back 10,000 or at most 20,000 years. Surprise! Now the team has dated and directly analyzed objects from archaeological layers at Border Cave, located in the foothills of Lebombo Mountains in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. The site has yielded exceptionally well-preserved organic material. Now, I have to say, I am so proud of this archaeological team that they are using geological data to date the dig. They didn't artificially date it in order to make it fit with their thesis or previous theories put forth by the high priests of paleology or paleontology. They are going by the geological date of the clay layers that they are digging in. Dr. Blackwell said their results have shown without a doubt that around 44,000 years ago, the people at Border Cave were using digging sticks weighted with perforated stones, like those traditionally used by the San. They adorned themselves with ostrich egg and marine shell beads and notched bones for notational purposes. They fashioned fine bones points for use as awls and poisoned arrowheads. One point is decorated with a spiral groove filled with red ochre, which closely parallels similar marks that San make to identify their arrowheads when hunting. Chemical analysis of the residues on a wooden stick decorated with incisions reveal that San objects used for the same purpose. It was used to hold and carry a poison containing ricinoleic acid found in castor beans. This represents the earliest evidence for the use of poison. A lump of beeswax mixed with the resin of toxic euphorbia and possible egg was wrapped in vegetal fibers made from the inner bark of a woody plant. This complex compound used for hafting arrowheads or tools directly dated to 40,000 years ago. It is the oldest known evidence of the use of beeswax. Warthog tusks were shaped into awls and possibly spearheads. The use of small pieces of stone to arm hunting weapons is confirmed by the discovery of resin residue still adhering to some of the tools, which chemical analysis has identified as suberin, a waxy substance produced from the sap of Podocaprus, yellow wood trees. Also in the news, and this is really fascinating, you know what melanin is, right? You know, it's the pigment that colors skin, eyes, hair, etc. It could soon be the face of a new generation of bio-friendly electronic devices used in applications such as medical sensors and tissue stimulation treatments. I'm amazed by it. I'm just fascinated by this. Melanin, which is a dark granular material, is for the first time, it gives remarkable insight into the electrical properties of this pigment and its biologically compatible bioelectronic features. Semiconductors are arguably the most important modern-day high-tech material. They drive all modern electronics. Said a study, co-author Professor Paul Meredith of the University of Queensland, the majority of semiconductors are made from inorganic elements or compounds such as silicone, silicon, or gallium arsenide. And by the way, that's the cobalt, boron, are used in solar panels, which are, as you know, around 19 to 21% efficient. Some broader band electronics are being played with right now and getting efficiencies up around 35 to 40%, which is kind of neat. Organic semiconductors, on the other hand, are a relatively new member of the semiconductor family and are composed of molecules containing carbon, hydrogen, and other elements. There are very few examples of natural organic semiconductors, and melanin was thought to be the very first example. Demonstrated to be such in the early 1970s, co-author Ben Powell, an associate professor at the University of Queensland, said that in semiconductors, such as those found in computers and mobile phones, electrons carry the electrical current. However, in biological systems, such as brains and muscles, ions carry the current, which is true. Usually it's calcium in muscles. We've now found that in melanin, both electrons and ions play important roles. The study points to a new way of interfacing conventional electronics to biological systems using a combination of ion and electron conducting biomaterials such as melanin. Melanin is actually able to talk to both electronic and ionic control circuitry, and hence can provide that connection role, said Professor Meredith about the study's finding. The culmination of 10 years of research and experiments, there are very few materials that meet these compatible bioelectronic requirements, and an insight into melanin's important biological functions and properties has been really crucial in this study. In recent years, the electronics industry has been driven to develop materials and components that are cheaper and more environmentally friendly. Organic conductors and semiconductors are widely viewed as having enormous potential in the regard of cheaper, safer electronic materials. The team is currently working on creating ion-based electrical devices using melanin with a view to ultimately connect them to actual biological systems like a bionic fixture of some kind that communicates with the body. Super interesting stuff. I mean, absolutely unbelievable frontier of invention. And it goes on and on. The University of California, Irvine, HRL Labs, has developed the world's lightest material. This material has a density of 0.9 milligrams per cubic centimeter. Right. Water has a density of 1 gram per milliliter. Absolutely fascinating stuff. The new material redefines the limits of lightweight materials because of its unique microlattice cellular architecture. The researchers were able to make a material that consists of 99.99% air by designing the 0.1% solid at the nanometer, micron, and millimeter scales. The trick is to fabricate a lattice of interconnected hollow tubes with a wall thickness 1,000 times thinner than a human hair. This is led by Dr. Tobias Schadler of HRL Labs. The material's architecture allows unprecedented mechanical behavior for a metal, including complete recovery from compression, exceeding 50% strain, and extraordinarily high energy absorption. You know what that means? That means that these materials can make up crash-absorbing materials for automobiles. These materials can make up the hulls of spacecraft, submarines, all kinds of aircraft. The materials actually get stronger as the dimensions are reduced to the nanoscale, explained UCI mechanical and aerospace engineer Lorenzo Valdivit, UCI's principal investigator on the project. Combine this with the possibility of tailoring the architecture of the microlattice and you have a unique cellular material. The novel material could be used for battery electrodes and acoustic vibration or shock energy absorption. William Carter, manager of the Architected Materials Group at HRL, compared the new material to larger, more familiar edifices, modern buildings, exemplified by the Eiffel Tower, the Golden Gate Bridge, are incredibly light and weight efficient by virtue of their architecture. We are revolutionizing lightweight materials by bringing this concept to the nano and micro scales. Aerographite is a water repellent, jet black, and electrically conductive material. It's produced by researchers from Kiel University and Hamburg University of Technology. It weighs only 0.2 milligrams per cubic centimeter, also very, very lightweight. But this is very strong. The new carbon-made material called aerographite is described in a paper in the journal Advanced Materials. It is jet black, electrically conductive, ductile, and non-transparent. With these unique properties and very low density, the material clearly outperforms all similar materials. Our work is causing great discussion in the scientific community. Aerographite weighs four times less than the world record holder up to now, said co-author Matthias Mecklenburg, a PhD student at the Hamburg University of Technology. With the exception of the material that we just described from Tobias Schadler, but you have to understand that this micro lattice, it weighs 0.9 milligrams per cubic centimeter, and this stuff is 0.2 milligrams per cubic centimeter. Both of these extremely lightweight. The micro lattice is 99% air. This stuff is 99.998% air. Our work is causing great discussions. The hitherto lightest material in the world, a nickel material that was presented to the public about 6 months ago, is also constructed of tiny tubes. Only nickel has a higher atomic mass than carbon. Oh, yeah, by a long shot. Also, we are able to produce tubes with porous walls. That makes them extremely light. That came from co-author Arnim Schuchard, a PhD student at Kiel University. Despite its low weight, aerographite is highly resilient. While lightweight materials normally withstand compression but not tension, aerographite features both an excellent compression and tension load. That means basically trying to pull it in two. It is able to be compressed up to 95% and be pulled back to its original form without any damage. That sounds a little bit like the mysterious material found at the Roswell crash. Interesting. Up to a certain point, aerographite will become even more solid and therefore stronger than before. Other materials become weaker and less stable when exposed to such stress. Also, the newly constructed material absorbs light rays almost completely. One could say it creates the blackest black. Think of the aerographite as an ivy web which winds itself around a tree, and then take away the tree. According to the scientists, further areas of application could be the electrical conductivity of synthetic materials. Non-conductive plastic could be transformed without causing it to gain weight. Static, which occur to most people daily, could hence be avoided. And due to its unique material characteristics, aerographite could fit into the electrodes of lithium-ion batteries. In that case, only a minimal amount of battery electrolyte would be necessary, which would then lead to an important reduction in the battery's weight. True, lithium-ion batteries, a 200-amp-hour battery weighs about 6 pounds, 7 pounds, something like that. Could be made lighter. Well, let's go ahead and take a break. Let me see if I can find something suitable for this hour, because we're running a little bit late. We'll play a little bit of Queen. We'll be right back after this.
Feeling seems to steal away. suspicion in your eyes.
It's late. I think it's my favorite Queen song. I don't know. Other people have different favorites, of course. Headbangers Unite, right? 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Mr. Jennings in New York, if you're out there listening, you can call in. Let's talk about the Iraqi dinar. By the way, in the book... Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. It did make it to number one on Amazon briefly. I would like it to get back close to that again. And time is perfect for that book. So if you're thinking about a Christmas present, which I know it's a little bit early, but I know times are hard. The book's out there for what, $14.95, something like that. If you buy it from Amazon, you're going to get it quick, no doubt about that. But if you buy it from my website, alienatednation.com, you're not only going to get the book autographed, but you're going to be able to get the entire book in audio as a bonus, instant download when you get your PayPal receipt, unless you're using Firefox. If you're using Firefox, that browser blocks PayPal links. So you will have to write me if you are using Firefox for the audiobook. Just give me your transaction number from PayPal, and I will send you the link. No worries. You'll get it. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. The main thing is that there's a chapter in that book called Guess Who's Coming to Dinar? And this is a... really nice analysis of what's going on with the Iraqi dinar, what I believe you can expect from the RV, the revaluation of the Iraqi dinar. It is going to be the financial scandal of the century, and we're still early in the century. That's how big it's going to be. This will be a multi-trillion dollar scandal. Rumors abound that some of the key players, the Bushes, the Romneys, the U.S. Treasury, that they're already taking their revalued dinars and cashing them in for dollars. But that's just a rumor. I've also heard that the Iraqi dinar has already revalued and they're not going to accept any outside of Iraq owners of the dinar cashing it in for any kind of currency, but that cannot possibly be. In the book, we talk about the tax burden that is going to be laid upon this. It will yield something like $85 billion to the federal government in taxes from people cashing in their dinars for dollars. And, by the way, those of you that were listening to the conference line, it is now back up and running. It has been kind of problematic tonight. We apologize for that. It is not studio problem. It is a Skype problem. But it is now back up and running. So if you want to duck out and still listen to the program, you can. 760-569-7676. And the passcode is 192919. Just put it on speed dial. All you have to do is put comma, comma after the 7676, and your phone will automatically dial the passcode, and then you're in, and you'll be listening. You won't be able to talk, but you can listen. Or you can go to xsquaredradio.com. If you have a Droid phone, click on the Droid app on the left-hand side and download it to your phone, and one click, and you're in. Just a little bit of conference updates if you didn't get it the first hour. The Wake Up Now conference that was to take place in Arizona has been canceled due to economic reasons. Not enough of you signed up. And the Maya 2012 conference, which is going to take place from the 13th to the 22nd of December. Although many hundreds of you clicked on the banner and went to the website and checked it out, none of you have signed up. Now, I know that it's not the quality of that conference, because if you want to be anywhere that's cool, the coolest place to be on December 21st, 2012 is at Chichen Itza. Come on. That's ground zero for the whole Maya calendar and everything. We got Maya elders. We got Greg Braden, myself, Maureen St. Germain. Many of the other leading people in this genre are going to be at that location. This is the conference of a lifetime. If you've never been to a conference, or you never plan to go to another conference, this is the conference of a lifetime. So be earnest about it. Those of you that clicked on that banner, go back, get your deposits in, and let's get going. I am going to try to get your email addresses, and I'm going to write you directly to try to convince you to come down with me. And if I can get your phone number, if you'll write me, we can talk about it on the phone. There's a way to figure this out. You don't want to let this opportunity go by. You've got to see yourself there. I know times are hard, but times might not continue. I'm not saying live like there's no tomorrow, but live like there's no tomorrow. See you at the conference, Maya 2012. It's the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com. Or you can write me directly at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and we'll talk about it. Let's discuss it, because this is not something you want to let go by. I can't believe several hundred of you clicked on that banner, went there, checked it out, and decided not to become part of it. That's just un-American. All right. Everybody knows that the center of our galaxy is a supermassive spinning black hole. What? No, everybody does know it. Okay, all right. Only the people that have read the Arc of Millions of Years series know it. I got you. Okay. But that was a lot of people that read that book. It's a series of books, four books, The Arc of Millions of Years. Most comprehensive work ever done on the origin and destiny of the Earth, especially the advent of 2012. So let's assume that there is a supermassive spinning black hole at the center of every galaxy. And the seeds of that have been discovered at the center of the Milky Way. Japanese astronomers using two radio telescopes have produced a map of carbon monoxide distribution in the central region of our galaxy. Yeah, carbon monoxide. While mapping the region, they identified three huge gas clumps and a number of intermediate mass black hole candidates. From 2005 to 2010, the team using the Atacama Submillimeter Telescope Experiment in Chile and the Nobuyama Radio Observatory NRO 45 meter telescope observed emission lines at wavelengths of 0.87 and 2.6 millimeters emitted from carbon monoxide molecules in an area of several degrees that includes the center of the Milky Way galaxy. By comparing intensity values of emission lines at different wavelengths, the astronomers were able to estimate temperature and density of molecular gas. In this way, they succeeded in drawing detailed distribution maps of warm, dense, molecular gas at the center of the Milky Way galaxy for the first time ever. Let me just explain that a little bit, how spectrography works, spectroscopy. What happens is the signal comes in, and then it is sampled, spread across a varying diffraction grating. And what happens is that these spectral lines constructively or destructively interfere with one another. And the constructive interference forms a spike. The destructive interference cancels itself out. Well, it's incredibly pertinent, because what happens is every single element, every single molecule, every single molecular bond, whether it's a single bond, double bond, triple bond, an ion, a free radical, has a unique frequency associated with the electron shells because of the mass of the nucleus. The electron shells form at spacings that are proportional to the amount of mass that's in the nucleus. So obviously, hydrogen, having one proton, has one S shell around it, and it can hold up to two electrons. It doesn't. It only holds one because of the positive charge of a single proton. But as you add more protons and neutrons to the nucleus, it becomes more massive and thus able to support an equal number of electrons, which are in various distributions of shells, S, P, and d orbitals. Those electrons have specific orbits, like our planets do around the sun. And what happens is, from time to time, in energetic states, all molecules jump electrons from one shell to another shell. Well, when the electron falls from a higher shell to a lower shell, it loses energy. That energy loss is called a photon. It emits a photon of a specific wavelength. That wavelength is absolutely unique to that particular molecular bond. Now, when you're looking at compounds like carbon monoxide, you actually have a carbon atom and an oxygen atom. You need more than one line, more than one spectral line, in order to identify the compound because of the bond between carbon and oxygen. It's unique, but it can bond with a single bond, a double bond, and that just gives you a different kind of energy with respect to these photons that come off. So what the Japanese were able to do is tune the diffraction grating, which looks a little bit like a quartz, how can I describe it to you? Very, very, very small prisms laid right next to one another, microscopic. And what happens is you move the diffraction gratings back and forth. It's called scanning. And as you scan, only those frequencies that will constructively interfere with one another form a spike on the screen. And so this 45-meter telescope was able to get a wavelength of 0.87 and 2.6, which is absolutely irrefutably identified with carbon monoxide. So that's how they were able to identify it. So that's how spectroscopy works. Next time somebody asks you, you can tell them. Well, the results are absolutely astonishing, says Dr. Tomoharu Oka of Keio University. It should be Keio University. Lead author of a paper reporting results in the Astrophysical Journal Supplemental Series. The warm, dense molecular gas in that area is concentrated in four clumps. Moreover, it turns out that these four gas clumps are all moving at very fast speed, more than 100 kilometers per second. That's pretty fast. That's about a third the speed of the solar wind. One of the four clumps contains Sagittarius A, the nucleus of the Milky Way galaxy. The remaining three gas clumps are objects we discovered for the very first time. It is thought that Sagittarius A is the location of a supermassive black hole that is approximately 4 million times the mass of the sun. It can be inferred that the gas clump Sagittarius A has a disc-shaped structure with radius of 25 light-years, and it revolves around the supermassive black hole at a very fast speed. On the other hand, the team found signs of expansion other than rotation in the remaining three gas clumps. This means that the gas clumps have structures that were formed by supernova explosions that occurred within the gas clumps. And I've already explained to you what a supernova is. This is a star that is at least four times more dense than our sun. It has to be that dense in order for this following life cycle to occur. Because you need a certain amount of mass in order to accomplish a supernova. What occurs is normally what you have is a hydrogen proton star, a hydrogen star. It's putting off all kinds of elements as it decays, but it's a fusion star. The hydrogen protons are mating up with other hydrogen protons, forming helium. Helium, as you know, is molecular weight 2, hydrogen molecular weight 1. Well, helium has two protons, two neutrons, two electrons. And it's quite stable. It's not really reactive with anything, although helium fusion can occur as well. The loss of mass of that proton from whatever a hydrogen proton weighs, I think it's something like 1.000992 grams per mole, it loses a little bit of mass in order to come together to make a helium proton. And that little tiny bit of mass times the speed of light squared is the amount of energy that's released. That's what we see as light from the sun. All that radiation that comes from the sun that makes life possible on this planet comes from that reaction. Well, all's well and good as long as two things persist. One, you have an ample supply of hydrogen protons so that you never run out of fuel. The other is that the mass of the sun stays at the same diameter. Well, as you know, if you listen to this program, what happens as stars age is they begin to run low on hydrogen. So the explosive force that's trying to blow the whole thing apart like a giant fusion bomb is balanced against the gravity to actually have that star keep its shape. But as the fuel runs low, the explosion begins to lose the fight with gravity. And so the mass of the sun begins to collapse into a smaller radius. That means you have the same amount of mass in a smaller and smaller area, which means gravity is becoming concentrated in a tighter and tighter spot. Well, if you have a sun that's four times more massive than our sun or larger, that can occur in such a way that those electrons that were floating happily out there in a shell around these protons can no longer resist. They can no longer stay in orbit or in their orbital shells, blinking in and out of whatever dimension they do. And what happens is the electrons begin to fall into the protons. Well, you know what happens when you take a plus one and a minus one and you add them together. You get zero. Plus one, minus one, at the beginning, you get zero. Neutral, neutron. All the hydrogen protons begin to change into neutrons. Now, at first, this happens pretty slowly because it's kind of an asymptotic relationship. That is to say, it starts at an almost imperceptible slope, and then it reaches a certain point, and then it climbs straight up the slope of increase. As the star gets smaller and smaller and cooler, it becomes a neutron star. Right before that occurs, you get all of these electrons falling into the protons at first a million, then a billion, then a trillion, then a gazillion, then a multi-gazillion squared. You get a shock wave when all those electrons collapse. Sort of like if everybody in the United States were to stand on a 3-foot platform and then at precisely the exact same moment were to jump off that platform onto the ground. You see, the concussion of everybody doing it exactly the same moment would be devastating to the planet. Fortunately, we all do it, you know, randomly and constantly, not 3-foot platforms, but we walk. It lacks the constructive interference to make anything happen on the planet, so everything goes on as normal. But not so in suns. That concussion causes a supernova, which cleaves off the atmosphere of the sun, whoosh, like that. Well, that energy, that pure energy blast that goes out, will consume all the planets that are in orbit around that sun and anything else that gets in its path before the energy dissipates at the square of the distance from the explosion and the shock wave becomes ineffectual as it goes out into space. So inside these supermassive gas clouds, there have been supernova explosions, which means inside those gas clumps, there are stars that collapsed. The largest gas clump has the largest amount of expansion energy, equivalent to 200 supernova explosions. The age of the gas masses is estimated at about 60,000 years. That's recent. That's like yesterday, cosmologically speaking. The researchers use the NRO, that's the 45-meter telescope I was talking to you about. It's about 150 feet across, to further examine the molecule's gas distribution, motion, and composition to determine whether supernova explosions caused the expansion. Observation clearly showed that the energy source is multiple supernova explosions, and that is responsible for the expansion. Supernova is a massive explosion that occurs, as I told you, when these stars explode. The solar system is located at the edge of the Milky Way galaxy's disk and is about 30,000 light years away from the center of the Milky Way. The huge amount of gas and dust lying between the solar system and the center of the Milky Way galaxy prevent not only visible light but also infrared light from reaching the Earth. Moreover, innumerable stars in the bulge and the disk of the Milky Way galaxy lie in the line of sight. Because we are nearing the galactic plane, we really can't see through. Therefore, no matter how large the star cluster is, it is very difficult to directly see the star cluster at the center of the Milky Way because we're in the Milky Way. The only way to do that is to leave the planet, leave the heliosphere, and basically leave the galaxy where we can actually look at the galaxy from outside the galaxy. Now that sounds like a science project worth doing. Huge star clusters at the center of the Milky Way galaxy have an important role related to formation and growth of the Milky Way galaxy's nucleus. It can be thought that the supermassive black hole at Sagittarius A, the nucleus of our galaxy, has also been grown up through these processes. In summary, the new discovery is the finding of cradles where these seeds of supermassive black holes form. That's just fascinating stuff. The more we learn about our galaxy, the more we understand how matter exists in the universe. Most of the universe is not visible to us. It is, however, quite massive. Dark matter, dark energy, make up about 95 to 96% of the mass of the universe, but we can't perceive it. We have affectionately called it dark matter because we can't see it, and I have often said on this program that may be a little arrogant. Maybe it's super bright matter. We're just too dark to see it. Could be the subconscious of the universe. And the other thing that we've discovered is that these very, very bright stars may have companions. That is to say, they're almost like binary stars. New research using data from the Very Large Telescope has revealed that the hottest and brightest stars, which are known as O stars, if you know what the chart of stars are, you would if you read the second chapter of Volume 1 of The Arc of Millions of Years. They're often found in close pairs, many such binary transfer mass from one to another, sort of like, they call it stellar vampirism, but it's sort of like you would see a black hole peel off gas from a star and down the spiral drain. But these stars close to one another form magnetic ropes between them and often pull matter one way or the other, usually from the larger star or to the larger star from the smaller star or the more dense of the two stars. Like when we look up at Sirius A and Sirius B, the more dense is actually a white dwarf, which we cannot see. The very bright star that we see is quite large, but not nearly as heavy as its Sirius companion. Many people, including Charles Balval, Robert Balval, believe that Sirius is a binary star with our sun. The two revolve around one another, and that's exactly why the pyramid is aligned with Sirius and has been for 11,000 years. If you know anything about the precessions of the equinoxes, you would know that the axis of Earth moves through the 12 signs of the zodiac approximately every 26,500 years. We're coming to the end of that cycle on December 21st of this year, the reset, the zero, 12 o'clock midnight of the Maya calendar. However, Sirius has still been aligned with the pyramid for 11,000 years. That seems pretty impossible unless the two suns are binary and actually rotate around each other, in which case we'll always be facing Sirius, even though we're moving through Sagittarius and into Aquarius, or from Pisces into Aquarius. Sirius is still lined up with us. Surprisingly, most of these pairs are experiencing disruptive interactions. The universe is a diverse place, and many stars are quite unlike the sun. An international team has used the Very Large Telescope. They also call it the VLT. That's short for Very Large Telescope. To study what are known as O-type stars, which have very high temperature, mass, and brightness, these stars have short and violent lives and play a key role in the evolution of galaxies. They also put off a tremendous amount of elements, silicon, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen. So those are the elements that make up the matter of planets and biological systems as well. They are also linked to extreme phenomena such as the vampire stars that I'm talking about. These stars are absolute behemoths, says Dr. Hughes Sanna of University of Amsterdam, Netherlands, who led a study published in the July 27th issue of the journal Science. They have 15 or more times the mass of our sun and can be up to a million times brighter. Now, you'd have to have a serious set of sunglasses for that. These stars are so hot that they shine with a brilliant blue-white light and have surface temperatures over 30,000 degrees Celsius. The astronomers studied a sample of 71 O-type single stars and stars in pairs in six nearby young star clusters in the Milky Way. By analyzing the light coming from these targets in greater detail than before, the team discovered that 75% of all O-type stars exist inside binary systems. That's because they're so dense and have so much gravity, 15 times as massive as our sun. They're going to attract other high-density bodies, which are usually stars. So that's my theory. A higher proportion than previously thought, and the first precise determination of this number. More importantly, though, they found that the proportion of these pairs that are close enough to interact is far higher than anyone had thought, which has profound implications for our understanding of galaxy evolution, although not very profound impact on our day-to-day lives. Still, makes good for coffee table conversations. You know, most people look at humans. Most humans look at humans, all animals look at humans, as troublemakers. We're the predators of the planet. We are, however, no matter what our aptitude or our intelligence, those are two different things, by the way, we tend to form highly structured elite societies, cliques, you know, social groups. Even children do it. Adults do it too. Birds of a feather, yada, yada, yada. You know how that goes. Well, we're not the only animals on the earth that form this. And I'm not talking about chimpanzees. I'm not talking about pecking order of birds. I'm talking about dolphins. Dolphins actually form cliques based on their skills. Scientists have found, suggesting that they could be the only non-human mammals to indulge in elite societies. I also know minke whales do it, and so do killer whales. It's a really interesting article. A clique is a kind of learned behavior. It's not something that's instinctive. It's not something that's handed down. It's something that you learn by watching others. Well, wild bottlenose dolphins bond over their use of tools. Oh, you didn't know dolphins use tools. Well, then this will be interesting to you. With distinct cliques and classes forming over decades as a result of their skills. The communities, which have been compared with societies such as Bullingdon Club in humans, mean the aquatic animals share their knowledge only with those in their own circle, passing it down the family line. It's secret. We don't share that with anybody else. The finding means that traits of inclusive inheritability and culture are no longer considered exclusive to human beings. Observing wild dolphins in Shark Bay, Australia, researchers from Georgetown University used hunting tools as a marker of dolphin societal habits. Noticing some dolphins in the area use a sponge to protect their beaks while hunting, they attempted to discover why the practice had not spread. Well, this is what they discovered. They found the useful tool had first been used by a single dolphin named Sponging Eve after she scraped her nose while foraging for food in rough sand. To solve the problem, she broke off a piece of sea sponge to protect her, going on to teach the behavior to her offspring. But two decades later, knowledge of the tool had not spread among the whole dolphin population in the area. Scientists observed 36 sponges and 69 non-spongers in the area over a 22-year period, taking careful note of their relationships. They found spongers, these were the dolphins that use sponges to protect their nose while they're foraging for food in rough sand. You know, they just kind of put their nose down in the sand and wiggle their heads back and forth, wiggle their snout back and forth to force morsels of food, clams, crabs, things like that, up out of the sand, and then they can eat them. Well, they were more cliquish, these spongers. They had more sponger associates and stronger bonds with each other than with non-spongers. Like humans, who preferentially associate with others who share their subculture, tool-using dolphins prefer others like themselves, strongly suggesting that sponge tool use is a cultural behavior. This tendency to associate with those most like themselves is, scientists believe, a critical role in human subcultures and may be true for dolphin society as well. Writing in the journal Nature Communications, a team led by Janet Mann reported, "To date, no material subcultures have been identified outside of humans. Recently, many biologists are moving beyond genetic inheritance to examine the processes involved in inclusive inheritability, which include culture. We sometimes think that traits such as culture are exclusively human, but a growing body of literature proves otherwise." The study also found the behavior was stronger in females, who were better at maintaining alliances. You're trying to save females are more clicky than males? Surely not. Once sponging behavior is established, female spongers formed clear cliques. Although, in-group identity has been noted in other animals, such as killer whales and budgerigars. The dolphin subcultures are believed to be the result of socially learned behavior rather than innate traits. Interesting stuff. Don't you find that fascinating? You can give us a call. We've got about 15 minutes left in the program. 888-429-5471. The Republican VP has been picked. It was, as we said on this program, Paul Ryan. And I was listening to the president say something tonight, which was pretty true words. He said, paraphrasing, of course, now we have a choice. You have a choice between moving forward with a philosophy that government can provide everything for you. All you have to do is give us everything you have. And the other philosophy, which is let's get government out of your way and let you do what you do, and you will buy more and sell more, and thus we'll be able to support what little government we need through basic taxes. I have often said on this program and out in real life, we don't need more taxes. We need more taxpayers. We don't need higher taxes. We need more taxpayers. That means we need people to get a job. Like Roland was saying tonight, minimum wage doesn't cut it in California unless you want to put four or five families in the same apartment. And that comes with other issues. To say that you're employed, but you're working at a job where you make 25% of what you're normally used to making, it doesn't cut it. To say that you have given up looking for a job because you've been through all the newspapers, all the headhunters, and you've worn holes in your shoes, doesn't cut it. Here in North Carolina, there are more single-location businesses than any other state in the union. Why is that? Because people in North Carolina can't find a job, and so they make a job. They make one for themselves and their family. They start a restaurant. They start mowing grass. They start painting houses. They start picking up trash. They start doing the things no one else wants to do, and they make a business out of it, and they suffer through it, and they support themselves and their family and their friends. That doesn't cut it. I have told you what we needed to do in the book Alienated Nation. We need to have a constitutional convention. We need to repeal three amendments, and we need to pass five more. It's as simple as that. Once that is done, the republic will be back in the hands of the people and their representatives. Right now, the republic is in the hands of a loose coalition of bureaucracies. Those bureaucracies squabble between themselves and wrap you up in so much tape that you cannot move. That doesn't cut it. So you have a choice. And if you honestly think that changing presidents is going to fix everything, then you haven't listened to this program long enough. Go back and listen to some archives. Educate yourselves. It is going to take more than that. Now, if R&R will face off against the agency government, if they will go up against the agency government and take it apart and remove its power over us, then they can save the republic. But it's been tried before. Every president that has tried it is dead. Enough said about that. Also, what happened this week, amazingly, wonderful, absolutely spectacular news from our buddies down at JPL. Curiosity landed itself on Mars, and it is doing a fantastic job. It landed at 1:31 Eastern Time on Monday of this week. NASA Chief Charles Bolden focused on Mars as the ultimate destination, for now, for human space exploration in a meeting with USA Today. He said, "I have no desire to do a Mars landing on our own," Bolden said. "The U.S. cannot always be the leader, but we can be the inspirational leader through international cooperation in space exploration." Yeah, we could always be the leader, Charles. And no, we can't do it alone. I say in the book, and I maintain the philosophy because I'm a lover of Gene Roddenberry's work, that we need to lay down our weapons and stop fighting on this planet. We need to begin to learn to live like Earthlings instead of tribes. You know, the administration plans are for $17.7 billion space agency to land an astronaut on an asteroid in 2025, then go to Mars by the middle of 2030s. It needs to happen much faster than that. The mission inevitably will be international, as any future human landings on the moon, Bolden said. We've already gone there first. The Obama administration's space plans have attracted criticism this year from some space state senators, such as Richard Shelby from Alabama, who disagreed with its emphasis on private space rockets to resupply the International Space Station rather than a heavy rocket that would send a spacecraft to circle the moon in 2017. Yeah, he would say that. But I don't think that governments need to be in charge of all this. I think private companies can do it. I think there's a return on the investment. NASA science chief John Grunsfeld put the odds as very high of the Curiosity missions finding chemical signs of habitable environment on the red planet perhaps 2.5 billion years ago. A human mission to Mars would send six astronauts who would take 6 months to get there and stay a month before returning on an eight-month trip back to Earth. I believe that most Westerners presume that a human mission to Mars will quite likely be multinational. I certainly think so, and indeed would prefer this approach, says former NASA chief Michael Griffin, who has criticized the administration's manned spaceflight plans in the past. "I do not believe that China makes such a presumption," Griffin adds by email. "I suspect that when China believes it is ready as a nation to go to the moon, it will do so by itself. And later on, exactly the same thing will be true of Mars." China announced plans on Tuesday to launch its third lunar probe next year, part of an effort aimed at a manned moon landing in the next decade. Or a womaned moon landing. NASA has safely landed three mobile spacecraft on Mars since 1997, including Opportunity, still roving after 8 years, Spirit, which has gone dark, and now Curiosity. Oh, real quick, I have a Drone Wars update. Coming in 2 weeks, we have Noel Sharkey. Noel Sharkey wrote an outstanding article in The Guardian, which is a UK magazine. Noel Sharkey is a professor of robotics at Sheffield University. And you know that we've been covering the drone wars here at X Squared Radio. And I do have a drone war update, quick 10 minutes on that. But Noel Sharkey is the only writer out there, and also a professor of robotics, that picked up on our perception that we are on a slippery slope of sanitizing murder. It makes the dehumanizing of the enemy so much easier that we are now on a slippery slope of immorality. So, quick drone war update. You're going to love that program, by the way. We'll send a newsletter out. If you're not a member of the newsletter, it's free. Go to xsquaredradio.com and sign up. I will send out the newsletter in about a week, maybe less, and we'll talk about Noel Sharkey and what he's going to bring to the program on the 26th. The Dark Sword. Yeah. Don't you love the names of these drones? The Dark Sword is a Chinese anti-drone drone. You know, we've talked about the drone killing drone here on this program. But the Dark Sword model portrays an elongated delta airframe and highly swept aft mounted wings. It has four cantilevered tail fins, the larger two of which are mounted at the top of the main delta wing, while the other two mounted beneath. The forward fuselage is dominated by an extremely large belly-mounted intake and two apparently retractable canards. The aircraft's rear fuselage poses other questions. Unlike the rest of the airframe, the area around where the engine nozzle would be located has been simply left as a vertical surface with a recess indicating the exhaust. This contrasts with the considerable efforts made at streamlining the remainder of the design, as it would generate considerable drag. I imagine that by the time they get this thing in the air, that rear section will be fixed. That is just there to throw you off. The inclusion of the canard surfaces reiterates the development links between current Chinese manned fighter aircraft, Western UCAV, that's short for unmanned combat aerial vehicles. Designs in contrast rely on inherent airframe instability and advanced fly-by-wire controls. But these fighter drones are designed to shoot other drones down, and they're designed to shoot aircraft down. Those of you that saw the movie Stealth know exactly what I'm talking about. This is a smart drone. And what it will do is, once it's launched, it will run a program without having to be flown by wire. It will run a program. And what it will do is, it will take a radar signature, a radar pattern that is sent to it as a receive-only signal. Once it gets a picture and location of all the targets, it will simply fly to them and destroy them. So it will obviously carry onboard weaponry. It will definitely be able to outfly a manned aircraft because it can turn in radiuses that humans cannot, because it can't stay conscious making the turn. They're going to use ramjet propulsion, and that's consistent. The canard services would have the application in low-speed profiles, but by retracting would significantly reduce drag in the deployment phase of a mission. An aircraft of this type would have extremely long range and be capable of meeting very rapid deployment goals, and conceivably could then support air-to-air operations after reaching its deployment area. In that context, Dark Sword hints at an operational concept that has little to do with operations in the near vicinity of China, and is instead part of developing ideas for the conduct of extremely long-range deployments, followed by highly dynamic operations. That concept is equally technologically challenging, but has a precursor in previously seen Chinese military ideas for being able to engage a future adversary at extreme distances. In other words, we're not talking about a defensive weapon. We're talking about an offensive weapon. Drones have had a profound effect on the way America fights its wars, allowing it to fight in new theaters while minimizing the risk to troops. The U.S. has used drones for decades, with early versions during World War II and the Vietnam War. But over the past decade, the Defense Department's development and production of drones has rapidly increased. We're going to be flying 30,000 of them over the United States. Most of those drones, if not all of those drones, will be manufactured right here in the United States. But what's to stop another country from launching a drone in U.S. airspace. How would we ever know? The U.S. military has gone from having just a few drones at the outset of the Iraq War to now over 7,000. And we're not alone, not by a long shot. The lure of enduring overhead surveillance and strike capability at a safe remove and at a relative bargain is just as appealing to the rest of the world's militaries as it is to us. Sure, American drone technology is a sought-after brand on the international arms market, but other countries have and increasingly are developing their own platforms. Allies like Israel. Israel has a drone factory right here in the United States, in Mississippi. I'll bet you didn't know that. Allies like Israel and adversaries like Iran have used reconnaissance drones in combat since the 1980s and continue to turn out new models. China is taking its lead from American drone models with knockoff Predators and Global Hawks. Today, more than 50 countries are using or developing unmanned aerial vehicles. Israel has the Heron TP. It has an impressive array of features that can fly for up to 36 hours at heights of over 40,000 feet, and it can carry a ton, 2,000 pounds of weight. The BAE Systems has built one called Tyrannus. Yeah, it's named after an ancient god. A semi-autonomous unmanned warplane. It is designed to fly intercontinental missions, and it will carry a variety of weapons, enabling it to attack both aerial and ground targets. It will further utilize stealth technology, giving it a low radar profile. It looks just like a B-1 bomber, the big flying wing. Boeing has the X-45, which is built by Boeing's Phantom Works, manufactured by Boeing Integrated Defense Systems. And then I have this real quick thing called the Future Drone. The attempted convention by 40 states to amend the Constitution was stopped by presidential executive order and a full court press by Homeland Security. Fleets of federal and UN drones patrolled the interstate's highways and known rural strongholds looking for known constitutionalist organizers. The market for drone killers blossomed and brought innovative technology to the forefront. Constitutionalist activists were targeted by federal drones, at first for surveillance and subsequent arrest on grounds of inciting an overthrow of the government. One of the drones was shot down by territorial guards and successfully back-engineered. The firmware was hacked, and hours after the plans were posted on a self-cloning blog, the workshop was destroyed by a drone attack using a Hellspark missile. The Hellspark missile is a 24-inch long version of the Hellfire missile designed to incinerate a radius of about 100 feet. Two engineers were killed, including one son and one nephew, all Americans. The recovered firmware plans allowed the development of the Remora drone killer. The ship has two motors. One is electric with a flying time of about 12 hours at virtually unlimited altitude. The second is a catalytic solid fuel motor that burns for about 10 seconds, capable of propelling the craft to about Mach 2.5. The 48-inch swept wing craft has a super light carbon body made of woven microtube fabric. With a capacitor that discharges seconds before impact, the carbon is energized into a solid crystal that can pierce titanium-skinned aircraft. The Remora is small enough to be undetectable when in flight. Completely radio silent, the Remora is designed to track the flight signals of drones and follow that signal directly to the aircraft. When the trajectory is locked, the solid fuel booster fires, and the Remora destroys the targeted drone like a supersonic kamikaze. Developed and built by small shops all over the country, the supply chain was impossible to stop. It could be set up on rooftops and trees and hidden in open fields with a minimum of camouflage. The Remora would self-launch when a drone guidance handshake signal was detected or descend from aloft, leaving no possibility for defense. The Remora is cheap to build and when released to the air would patrol for 10 to 12 hours before self-conflagration upon battery exhaustion. The craft burn up entirely high above the ground, leaving no trace. The Remora is the state's only defense against the fleets of federal and UN drones that constantly hunt for constitutional defenders. That's just a snapshot of what it could be like. That is not real. It was made up by me. But it sounds real. It could be real. It could be us. I could just tell you right now that if we head down the path of trying to defend ourselves against our own federal government, it's going to be a battle of drones. It's going to be where we are. I'm Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio. And we'll see you next week right here. Remember to look for the good in others and help it to grow a little every day. And before too long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying peace, Earth Explorers.